This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick with a raspy voice thanks to a cold. And lo and behold, here we are. It's 2024, election season. And the Iowa caucuses are on Monday, the first stop on the long journey to November 5th. There's been a lot of news about the two candidates who seem to be competing for second place in the Republican Party, Nikki Haley of South Carolina and Ron DeSantis of Florida, who visited all 99 counties in Iowa.
Oh, what is that? An icy? Yeah, that's probably a lot of sugar, huh? Good to see you.
But dominating these primaries, of course, is a candidate who has not participated in debates, who barely campaigned, and is polling at more than 50%.
Don't stay home, just please, you know? The polls are showing we're going to win by a lot. And worst thing you can do, oh, let's just stay home, Alice. Let's watch it on television. We don't want to do that. You got to get out, because the more we win by, we're shooting for November, because we got to send a message. We got to send a message. We can't be beaten, because if we are beaten, we're not going to have a country left anymore. They're destroying this country.
Two of the New Yorker's political reporters have been in Iowa covering the run-up, Robert Samuels and Ben Wallace Wells. Now, Ben, you just wrote an illuminating piece about tensions within the Christian right, and that is incredibly influential in Iowa. You talk with pastors coming out for and some against Donald Trump, and you spoke to a pastor named Joshua Graber, who opened a rally for Trump by saying, "We ask those who stand against him be put to silence." Now, that's quite a turn of phrase. Who is Graber?
Joshua Graber is a man who leads a very, very small church in a town called Vinton, Iowa. It's a Baptist church. He's somebody who, like a lot of the Trump pastors who tend to exist outside of the existing evangelical establishment, was not especially politically active until a few years ago. But also, like a lot of pastors in Iowa, he has come over the Biden years, and maybe a little bit before that, to see his version of Christianity is really up against the wall. You know, over the last decade and a half, we've gone from having evangelical Christians be something like 23% of the U.S. population to something like 14%. When you look at, you know, a public opinion environment in which the Dobbs decision remains hugely unpopular and a real challenge for Republicans, there is a feeling, I think, of sort of existential threat that Christians like them are on the verge of being ostracized or driven out of power entirely. When I talk to, you know, both Trump and DeSantis pastors across Iowa, they tended to see the world a little bit similarly. Even the DeSantis people, that old evangelical establishment that, you know, pushed Huckabee and Santorum and Cruz to victory in Iowa, their sensibility is quite similar too. They also seem very stressed. They also have a kind of exaggerated sense of precipice. And so, you know, to have this fighter, you know, for you in a kind of crisis is something that's more appealing to these guys.
Robert, why didn't DeSantis connect at all? And how is Nikki Haley connecting? What's been her success, and to what extent can she be successful there?
Well, I like to think of Iowa as having three major buckets. The first bucket would be the evangelical vote. Those are the votes that are typically together that have allowed candidates like Cruz and Santorum and Huckabee to win in the past. There are the Chamber of Commerce type Republicans, what we used to call the H.W. Bush or the Reagan Republicans. Also, there's a very strong foreign policy sense in Iowa, and people tend to gravitate toward more hawkish foreign policy experiences. Those three buckets don't really loan themselves to DeSantis in a way that's distinct from Donald Trump. Now, Nikki Haley not only has the hawkish policies that are pretty popular in Iowa, people want folks who'll go tough on China, who'll be hard on Mexico, but she has that Chamber of Commerce sense about her, and she has leaned more conservative. It also helps that she is more of a people person.
9 days until the caucuses, and guess what that means for you? No more commercials. No more text messages, no more your mailbox being full with mail. I know you are excited, but also get excited because this is when you can really set the tone of where we're going in our country.
Nikki Haley seemed to be having a few decent weeks in the conventional sense. And then she was asked about the Civil War. And she did not care to summon that slavery might have been an essential factor in the Civil War. Is that something that just elite media care about, or do people in Iowa pick up on that too?
What I think it exposed for them is the idea that there's a liberal media who likes to ask gotcha questions, that they're a country that's preoccupied by race. And I actually think that answer that she gave probably played off better than people presume it did, because so many people are desirous of moving past race.
Ben, again and again and again, every time that Donald Trump has been in these races, the press goes through a period of self-flagellation. We must learn the Trump voter more intimately. We didn't do it well enough last time. What are you learning that's new?
There is a sense that that conservative America is losing, that I think is really profound and really alters how many conservative voters think and behave, you know? And we, you know, from our perch, might look at, you know, Trump having been elected very recently, at the structure of the Supreme Court, at the kind of disproportionality of the Senate and the Electoral College, and say, what are these people talking about? You know, this thing is set up for conservatives to succeed. This isn't becoming a more progressive country. But because the society is changing, because the culture is changing, because it's changing in ways that are, you know, moving away from many, especially social conservatives, I think there is a sense of desperation and fear that I can't quite, you know, justify myself. It feels exaggerated to me, but is present again and again and again.
When it comes to thinking about Donald Trump, he's not trying to save anyone. He's trying to save himself. And people are responding to it, I think, in ways that are deeper than they have before. Is they actually see him and the tumult that he's going through as a proxy for some of the cultural issues that they think they're losing. The core of it is, if Donald Trump is president, I can do whatever I want to do, right? I can be the type of American I want to be, and I won't have anyone trying to take that away from me or telling me I'm wrong all the time. And I think that's the message that continues to resonate, and in a lot of ways resonates even more deeply than in 2020 or 2016.
No, I know the Democrats are not a factor here in Iowa, but what are you hearing about the Biden presidency and Joe Biden?
One of the surprising things, at a Nikki Haley event, you will run into a lot of Obama, Trump, Biden voters. And one of the things that really surprised me was this belief that Joe Biden is actually presiding in a way that's more liberal than he had presented. They think he's too palsy-walsy with the squad and the Green New Deal, and he's too quick to acquiesce. Now, that's not something that I hear a lot in Washington, D.C., but I think it's really resonant that people think he's acceded to the radical left.
Now, you can read Ben Wallace Wells and Robert Samuel's reporting from Iowa at newyorker.com. Do 91 indictments, do outlandish statements only add to his support, or in the end, will they begin to diminish it?
When it came to the Republican primary electorate, they proved to be a political advantage.
Susan Glasser writes a column for us about Washington, and she's thinking hard about the real prospect of a Trump victory.
We can say that as more or less a statement of fact, in the sense that Donald Trump began last year actually, you know, potentially challengeable, at least as far as the polls went. He had about an average around 45% support nationally from Republicans last year. As the four different indictments in four different criminal cases began to be filed, his numbers went up and up and up. He consolidated support as a result of the backlash that he was able to engender around these indictments. What does it mean for the general election? The survey suggests that—
Before you get to the general election, are we already writing off the Republican nomination?
Let's put it this way. Were someone other than Trump to emerge now as the Republican nominee, it would represent an almost unprecedented outcome. There is the very real prospect, David, that Trump would secure the nomination and also that it would be over for all intents and purposes as a race, as early or earlier than any primary race that we're familiar with in recent times. He could have it essentially all over and done with by early March, Super Tuesday. As a matter of the general election, you asked sort of the question in many ways, which is, will all of these court cases, would a conviction in any one of them or all of them have the effect of finally spelling the political end of Donald Trump? There's a small subgroup of Republican voters who say that it would make a difference to them were Trump to be convicted in any of these cases. And again, because of the highly polarized nature of our politics right now, we're not talking about running a national 50-state campaign or even the campaigns when you and I were young, say back in 1976 when I was a kid, 25 states were basically genuinely toss-up races in that very close 1976 election. Today, that number is likely to be no more than 5 or 6 battleground states. So the real question is, are there a significant, you know, small number of Republicans, 6%, 10%, whatever the number is, that just won't vote for Donald Trump if he is convicted of a crime? So you don't need the answer to be, I got to convince 51% of Republicans. The answer is, I need to convince 6% of Republicans in Arizona or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin.
I have to say, as Americans, we lack imagination about ourselves sometimes, it seems to me. We lack it, and maybe for good reason, maybe that's part of Americanness, that we lack the darkest sort of imagination, as if certain things that happen elsewhere can happen here. And I wonder, when you think about this election of 2024, and if it turns out to be that either Trump wins it flat out, or things end in the possible mess that they could end yet again, what are the outcomes in terms of the daily lives, the civic lives, the foreign policy lives of this country that will be the consequence?
Failure of imagination is one way of thinking of it. Amnesia, perhaps, is another way of thinking of it, because the U.S. has certainly been sorely tested before at other moments in its history. I said this to somebody recently, like, oh, how do I write a story? You know, how do I write a column about 2024? And it's going to be such a stressful, awful year no matter what. And they said, well, here's a thought for you. What if 2024 is actually the best year of the next coming years rather than the worst? What if things get much, much worse in ways that we're still very hesitant to even acknowledge as possibilities?
I can almost hear a lot of listeners listening and thinking that we are doing the oral version of doom scrolling as a kind of liberal indulgence for public radio and all the rest. Why is that not true?
Well, I mean, ask the people in Hungary or Poland or Turkey what happens when an illiberal, authoritarian-minded leader comes to power and uses the tools of democracy in order to dismantle that democracy. These are not idle speculations. You know, there is a pretty clear agenda being formulated. It starts not only with weaponizing the Justice Department to indict your political opponents. It starts with the takeover and the politicization, say, of the civil service, which is a 100-year-long effort in the U.S. to build a nonpartisan professional bureaucracy in the United States. Trump has already written up an executive order. In fact, he imposed that executive order at the end of his first term. It was just too late to actually take effect, and Joe Biden immediately rescinded it. So they could enact a sweeping politicization and deprofessionalization of the executive branch.
This is the order that would have stripped federal civil servants of employment protection, allowing the president to fire them at will.
Yet, one assumes that if Trump actually, in this extra thought exercise, comes to power, he has won a political victory such that you can expect that one, if not both, houses of Congress are also supporting him and are also Republicans. When he said that he was going to leave NATO, this is something that he just didn't have the capacity to execute on. Well, now he can do so. Vladimir Putin has every incentive to continue the war in Ukraine to see whether Donald Trump is going to become the president. Well, what's going to happen in a very concrete sense that affects millions of lives, not just in the United States, but around the world. And so it's not doom scrolling. In fact, quite the opposite. I feel like there is, to a certain extent, one of the animating things that perhaps has enabled Trump to continue to do as well as he's doing in the national polls is a sense of kind of collective helplessness slash averting of the gaze, perhaps a sense of powerlessness, like, well, what are we going to do? And maybe it won't be so bad after all. Now is the time to think in a very concrete and specific way of the ways in which a Trump victory can and would have a specific effect, not only on American policy, but on individual lives.
One of the most striking things about the biography or biography in power that you and Peter Baker wrote about Trump was the day-to-day chaos in the Oval Office and the seeming incompetence of that White House. And one, at certain points, read that book with a certain sense of, well, he's certainly an authoritarian, but he's bad at it. In other words, he didn't have the ruthless efficiency of some historical authoritarians, and that more malevolent things could have been accomplished in a four-year period than were.
I'm going to be, you know, he keeps, we love this guy. He says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? I said, no, other than day one.
Will he be better at being an authoritarian in 2024 if he wins? And who would assist him in the effort?
A couple important changes would be taking place here. Because his big takeaway was basically, I didn't have enough loyalists surrounding me. And he thinks that was his own critique of his first term, if he was sharing it with you. And he's going to be looking for people who he defines loyalty essentially as willingness to carry out my agenda, whatever that agenda may be. The other thing is no guardrails. Okay, so he's proved in his first term that impeachment is essentially dead, a dead letter as far as Donald Trump is concerned when it comes to acting as a constraint on him, because he would have been, under the scenario we're talking about, he's reinstalled in office after having survived not one but two impeachments and essentially shown the toothlessness of impeachment as the tool of constraint that the founders envisioned, because there's no scenario in our divided country where really a president of any party is going to be faced with a Senate that has the overwhelming majority that would be required to have a Senate conviction. So no impeachment. And then the final guardrail that's completely gone here, of course, David, is that Donald Trump wouldn't be running again for another term in office. And, you know, so again, he's not even worried about facing the voters if he were to have another term in office. So then we're in a totally different territory. So for all intents and purposes, it's fair to say he would be absent the constraint of having to face the voters as other presidents and politicians do.
Within the realm of the possible, and within the realm of the possible for a man of Joe Biden's current capacities, achievements, and downsides, what is his scenario to turn this around?
What you get publicly is also, to a striking degree, what you get privately. Speaking privately with senior Democrats recently, they've also been asking these questions of the White House, and they get back essentially the same answer, which is, we've got this.
What does that mean, we've got this?
We're going to gut it out. The fundamentals are much better than you think. Uh-huh. For those who think that Trump is a uniquely pernicious assault on the American system, there's not going to be 1 hour of the year in which you can comfortably rest on the idea that Biden is secure in victory.
Susan Glasser, thank you so much. We'll be back to you again and again.
David, I'm going to go and pull back the covers over my head, I'm afraid, after this conversation.
Exactly. Susan Glasser's best-selling account of Donald Trump's presidency, written with Peter Baker, is called The Diviner. You can read her weekly column on Washington at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A new version of The Color Purple is in theaters now. It was released just at the end of the year, just in time for awards season. It's a story that's been told and retold over 4 decades since Alice Walker's best-selling novel was first published.
The color purple is unique in the canon of Black female literature because of how many lives and shapes it has taken over the years.
Doreen St. Felix is a critic for The New Yorker.
Alice Walker's novel was first adapted in the Steven Spielberg film, which I think we're all very familiar with, in part because there are these scenes that became so iconic.
You told Harpo to beat me.
It was that mule, Pa. Old Joy. Old Joy the mule, I tell you, I was out there trying to plow that Northfield, and the mule just went crazy.
I think we live in an era of remake after remake after remake. I wasn't convinced that we needed necessarily to have a new envisioning of the story, which has been a novel, which has been a film, which has been a musical twice over. And all of the intellectual worries or anxieties that I had dissipated in the room, because what the film created was a sense of fantasy, a sense of magical realist escape. I was very moved by the idea that a young Black male director and his young cast could decide to take this monolith, this cultural story that is absolutely, you know, it's an amber, and decide to change it, decide to make it reflect what they see to be the concerns of Black millennials of today. I think of The Color Purple, the musical. You walk out of it feeling a lot lighter, almost as if you've just watched a fairy tale. And it's a very interesting choice. And I loved talking to Danielle about the reasons, the justifications with respect to choosing to tell the story on that register.
Danielle, of course, is Danielle Brooks, who starred in both the 2015 stage version and in the new film. She plays the character of Sophia, who was first portrayed on screen by Oprah Winfrey. Doreen spoke with Danielle Brooks about acting in Winfrey's shadow and much more.
I saw the movie maybe 2 months ago.
Okay.
And it was a really small screening. It was a bunch of journalists, and you know, journalists don't like to be emotional when they watch a movie.
Oh, really?
They like to be professional. But for me, it was a completely emotional experience, specifically because I kept thinking, I kept doing this like twinning in my mind. Coleman Domingo playing Mr., you're thinking of Danny Glover, and you're thinking of him inheriting that. I'm watching you playing Sophia, and I'm thinking of you inheriting
Oprah. That's deep, yeah.
Fantasia and inheriting Whoopi. This is also Fantasia's first feature film. And that is what is so particular, I think, about the Black performer community, is that it is small forcibly for reasons that we all understand, but then it does create this like amazing, I don't know, inheritance is the word to use for it.
I love that. There is this inheritance, this symmetry that happens, this crazy, this lineage that you start to find yourself in.
And I also have a meta full circle moment sitting here with you and talking because I saw you.
Oh my gosh.
On Broadway, I went with my friend, and I had mostly known The Color Purple at that point as Alice Walker's text and then Steven Spielberg's film. And I think sometimes it can be hard to track what is adapted from what. So the musical is adapted from the film. And so there's these layers of change and adaptation. And now having seen the film, I was wondering like if you could speak to how this story maybe expands or contracts when it's just having to be just on the stage.
Oh, yeah.
Versus, you know, I think you guys shot down south,
we shot in Georgia.
Right. Yeah, and so what's your experience of having the location change and
That's
how it changes the story?
Question is night and day in a lot of ways. Yes, our adaptation, which was directed by John Doyle in 2015, it was stripped down. It was bare stage, just wood, as you saw, just chairs in our imagination. And the audience had to go on that ride with us in our imagination. But with film being actually in Georgia, feeling the hot Georgian sun, being on plantations, seeing slave houses behind us, actually holding a 10-pound baby and having to be careful with their child. It opens up the world. And now I felt like I was painting with an endless amount of colors. I've enjoyed stepping into both, you know, exploring Sophia so deeply with 8 shows a week for a full year of my life. I know her very much inside and out, but there's so much more discovery now when you have everything that you need.
Right. I think of Color Purple as being the epic of our time, especially, you know, both you and I are Black women. And my copy of Color Purple, I got from my mother.
Yes.
Who then gave it to my sister, who's older than me. And then I read it. And I think what's interesting is as you age with this story, you maybe feel your identification shift.
For sure.
Because Celie is, you know, the heroine, and she's been described as beleaguered. She comes from an environment that's completely shaped by abuse. Mm-hmm. And then she's able to go through kind of like a feminist awakening. And I was wondering, what's your relationship with the character having grown, since being in the revival in the mid-2010s to now being a mother, having been married?
My life has changed a lot.
Right.
When I stepped into this role in 2015, I was 25.
Right.
And I was very single, which I kind of needed to be, like, shooting Orange Is the New Black and doing Color Purple at the same time. But the life experience was different. My confidence was different because I'm also still coming off of a lot of no's. And so it was very interesting playing Sophia, because when I had become Tony nominated, I had imposter syndrome. Mm. And I immediately was like, I don't understand how I'm in this position. They're going to the audience is going to see me as a fraud. You know, how could this beautiful thing be happening to me? Which is super odd, because I did do the work. It's so crazy how our brains work, you know? But it was singing Hell No every night that pulled me out of that fear.
All my life, I've had to fight. I had to fight my daddy, had to fight my brothers, my cousins, my uncles too. But I never, 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 never thought I'd have to fight in my own house.
And what's Hell No about?
Hell No for Sophia is about, obviously, saying hell no to the abuse, right? Saying hell no to gender norms and to the oppressor and really finding your power. And but for me, every night, it was about saying hell no to my fears, saying hell no to this notion that I'm not enough, that I'm not worthy. That's what I was fighting, battling every day on that stage. And now, playing her, having become a mother of a beautiful 4-year-old girl named Freya.
She's the lock screen on your phone, right?
She is the lock screen on my phone. Yes, wearing purple. And then becoming a wife now, mm-hmm. learning what commitment means, mm-hmm. which is so crucial to the story when it comes to Sophia and Arpo. And I just really love, like, when I think about her being so radical, like, these are women that are coming straight off of slavery.
Right.
And for her to, you know, really try to break the cycles of abuse within her marriage. You know, this is a woman who had 6 children when kids were being killed, you know, thrown into the seas or snatched away from them, as we've seen with Celie's character. And so, yeah, there's pieces that I've definitely taken with me now playing Sophia.
Right. I am interested in your relationship to your castmates.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading, I think you, Fantasia, Barrino, and other people were involved in a talk a couple of weeks ago. And during it, Fantasia, who also was in the musical,
yes,
described playing Celie as a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a cross that she hasn't always been able to carry.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about, I guess, like, the psychological state of exactly what we were just talking about, bringing your life experience to bear on these characters. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the space like between each other, given that pretty much everyone had either performed in the musical before or at least had a really deep emotional relationship to the text? Like, what was it like when you guys were filming?
Spiritual. From day one, the first day we shot the last scene, which is us around the oak tree, which we call the Miss Oprah calls the angel oak tree. But you can truly, I mean, we're in Savannah, Georgia. There are truly slave houses right next to us. You can see them.
It's the most haunted city.
It's so
in America.
Haunted. I mean, I live there now and I was born in Georgia and I grew up in South Carolina, so I get it. You can't help but think about like the brothers and sisters that might have been lynched on those trees. You know, there's a spirit, and Taraji said so beautifully, like when we were there, like, do you feel that? Like, if only that tree could talk, you know? So it really did start out very ancestral, because what we know is that this thing that we're doing is so much bigger than ourselves. The healing that has taken place, not only within the cast, but also that permeates to the audience. I remember being in the theater, and when we're singing the final number, and we say, Amen.
Amen.
And audience members are holding each other's hand. They didn't even know each other. And they are grasping for each other's hand and crying because there's a healing that truly was happening and that is now taking place again. I've known Coleman for a long time. Sorry, I'm getting emotional because there's just so much to be grateful for, being that today I can call myself a Golden Globe nominee and I think about the journey and running into Coleman Domingo on 42nd Street. And at the time, I was having so many odd jobs trying to pay my rent and going up to him and him saying, after me expressing, you know, I hope there's a place for me in this industry. I really don't see it. Mm. And him encouraging me and saying, no, you got to keep going. I don't know you that well, but I can tell there's something in you. You have to continue to go. I'm just in awe of how this journey with Color Purple has come so full circle for me. Mm. And after, you know, getting blessed with so many jobs that I've had, this is still in my 11 odd years of being in this industry, my first studio film. Mm-hmm. It's a cutthroat business. That's one of the first things I learned was like, oh, this acting thing that I just deemed as like fun, play, my therapy, my happy place, there's a business attached to it. And it's not always fair. And it's not always kind. And it's definitely not for the weak. Mm. So the fact that I've just gotten to this point in my career when I've wanted to give up and throw in the towel, I'm grateful for my journey. I'm sorry, I'm crying.
No. You're making me cry. Did you or the cast members develop relationships with performers who had done the roles before, whether it's in the film or in the musical?
Yeah, I've definitely formed a bond with Miss Oprah Winfrey. Once she called me on that Zoom to personally pass the baton,
I am here representing all things purple to tell you that you are our Sophia.
And a lot of people are like, how do you have any pressure? You played her for a year. I mean, Miss Oprah was there almost every day, you know, on set.
Oh, really?
Yeah, watching the most iconic scenes. But huge shoes to fill, but I feel like she really allowed me to be the cobbler of my own shoe.
Right.
She still held my hand through the journey because Sophia, as we know, as you said, is not an easy character to play. So there were moments where, you know, you have to shoot things over and over and over again. And you think that you've like shed that scene, like you're done with that scene. And then they come back 2 days later and they're like, we want you to shoot it again. And this is the dinner scene.
And what was the dinner scene?
The dinner scene was the pretty much is almost like the 11 o'clock number. It's the final, you know, big hoopla. Like everyone is coming into their own at this moment in Sophia's life. Her spirit is pretty much dying. She's a shell
because she's just been in jail for many years because she refused to work for Miss Millie and talked back.
That's right.
Right.
So the world has now killed her song, killed her spirit, taken her song and killed her spirit. And she finds that strength again in that moment when Celie stands up for herself. She begins to find her strength again.
That's Danielle Brooks, who's in the new film Of the Color Purple. She's speaking with Doreen St. Felix, and she'll continue the conversation in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll continue now with the conversation between Doreen St. Felix, a writer on culture for The New Yorker, and the actress Danielle Brooks. Brooks cut her teeth on the show Orange is the New Black, and she went on to have a key role in The Color Purple. She plays Sophia in a 2015 stage revival of the musical, and she plays the character again in the new film version, directed by Blitz Bazawule. This new version is pretty different from its predecessors in some very interesting ways. Doreen says it reflects the concerns of its millennial director and cast, and it's got a feeling of magical realism. The pain and the trauma are still there, but it's undergirded this time around by a sense of joy. So here's Doreen speaking with Danielle Brooks.
In this film, we get more of Harpo's development as a character, and it does feel like it's addressing questions of masculinity that, frankly, aren't really addressed in even the book and the film adaptation.
100%. The fact that this was directed by a Black man has opened up parts of this story that we didn't even know existed, because how would we, you know? The perspective of Steven Spielberg is much different from our director, Blitz Bazaoule. There's so many moments like what we're now discovering, like with Corey playing Harpo, like how that box was open, you know, and we're brought into his world, and we're seeing who he truly is and what he's fighting against, and the relationship between his father and him trying to fight against what he's being taught, and how, you know, Mr. can't fight against what he's being taught by his father. Mm-hmm. We get this generational lineage of trauma that we didn't see before, and that was built out of conversations had with Blitz in the rehearsal process. I love one thing that Blitz did. And at first I was like, what is he doing? But there's a famous line where Suge comes in for the first time to Mr. and Celie's house, and she sees Celie and she says, "You sure is ugly.
You sure is ugly."
And at first I was like, that is an iconic line. How are you going to get rid of that? And then I realized after hearing Blitz talk about the reasoning, here we go again, if he would have kept it in, perpetuating this thing where Black women put other Black women down. Mm-hmm. She's been put down enough. Is it really necessary in this rendition to continually have that happen, have a Black woman speaking ill of another Black woman? So I really just appreciated that just thoughtfulness of what are we saying to this next generation? So I just loved that we, as a collective, were very conscious of the storytelling.
I'm beautiful. Yes, I'm beautiful.
The truth of the matter is that the original Color Purple is an imperfect book. That's what makes it so alive as an organism, because other authors are able to come in and draw aspects from the book out more into the forefront, and then also choose to shuttle away certain other things. And I think the way the relationship between Celie and Suge Avery, who is, you know, she's the vision of glamour. She comes to see Mister. They have this off and on relationship. She's a jazz singer. So she kind of represents like Black culture. Mm-hmm. She's a symbol of Black culture in the early 20th century. And before, you always think of Suge as like completely dominating Celie. And their erotic moment is not one that's necessarily based in love. Mm. It's based in like curiosity and other things. But in the film, the moment is unlike anything I've ever seen before, because it creates a kind of montage where their song together, Fantasia and Taraji, puts them into the world of like entertainment. They're dancing together. They're imagining being on the same level field where Celie is as glamorous. And that was something I really appreciated when you think about the fact that people tend to forget that The Color Purple is a queer story.
I love that we went there.
Yeah.
I love that we went there. Even though everyone should see this, even though everyone will connect to it, this moment for the Black community to get to see two Black women loving on each other is so crucial. Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes from generational behaviors of self-hate, but also homosexuality being deemed as horrible, which I do not believe personally at all. But I feel like because people, the aunties, the uncles, mm-hmm. the great-grandmothers, love this story so much, this is an opportunity for them to look at things a little different, really understand what love is about. And I think that's what you get with Celie and Suge. It's not the sexual portion of it. It's about the love, mm-hmm. teaching each other how to love each other, how to love themselves. Blitz did not shy away from that. They did kiss for way longer in our version than the last, you know. But as you see, like when they did the version in 1985, how much pushback they got from different organizations like NAACP. And it's like, look how far we've come.
Absolutely.
Thank God we are moving in a better direction. Mm-hmm. I just love that element in our story.
Thank you so much, Danielle, for spending time with me today.
Thank you. I loved speaking with you. Rising like the sun is the hope that sets
us free. Your heartbeat. The New Yorker's Doreen St. Felix speaking with Danielle Brooks. Brooks plays Sophia in The Color Purple, which is in theaters now. And you can always read Doreen St. Felix at newyorker.com.
Dancing the Tango, Priscilla Presley and her partner Louis Van Amstel.
All right, so what happens on the show is that half the dancers, one in each couple, is a professional ballroom dancer. These people are champs. And each one of those ballroom dancers is paired with a so-called star.
Well, that is the throaty, inimitable voice of Joan Acachella, the New Yorker's longtime dance critic. There was nobody better on ballet and modern dance, the classics, but Joan was perfectly happy to analyze Dancing with the Stars, too, and she was great on gossip. She was the higher version of TMZ.
Although the show makes a sort of pretense of exploding sexual stereotypes, mm-hmm. so the women talk about how tough they are and what competitors they are, and the men go through the homosexual anxiety business, mm-hmm. where they wonder whether dancing is going to, you know, challenge their status as
be
heterosexuals.
Be too girly for them or something.
Exactly. actually, the stereotypes are very much in force. I mean, with
I loved Joan Acachella's voice. She would always begin her notes with a throaty, dearest, and then have at it. Hilarious, brilliant, discursive. Or you'd call her and wait out 14 rings and get her answering machine. She loved to screen her calls, but then she would panic and pick up the receiver and scream, yes! And the conversation would begin. And her voice on the page, her voice in her essays was unbelievably vivid. I sometimes thought she wrote like a combination of Virginia Woolf and an old-fashioned sports writer, as if she were watching her 200th performance of George Balanchine's Jules with all of ballet history in her head while joyfully puffing on a stogie in the corner of her mouth. Joan could be tough. She could be disapproving. She was no patsy for the dull or the aggressively earnest. But as a critic, Joan Acachella was a lover above all. Her passion for Balanchine left you passionate for Balanchine, not because she was dictatorial in her judgments, a bossy critic, but because she was so winning and so convincing. And so thanks to her attention to something of enormous value, you took notice too. You followed in the wake of her sensibility, and your life had changed a little. And so how do you thank someone enough for that? Joan Acachella died a week ago, and I'll tell you what time well spent is. Time well spent is reading Joan Acachella's work, any of Joan's work, and you can find a hell of a lot of it at newyorker.com. Everybody here is grateful for that. I'm David Remnick. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.